time for a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Jim Douglas. Jim Douglas is a longtime peace activist, theologian, and writer. He is co-founder of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, located next to the Trident nuclear submarine base at Bangor, Washington, and the co-founder of Mary's House, a Catholic worker house of hospitality in Birmingham, Alabama. He is the author of several books, including Resistance and Contemplation, The Nonviolent Coming of God, Dear Gandhi, Now What? Letters from Ground Zero, co-authored with Shelley Douglas and Bill Livermore. And he is here to talk about his new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Jim, thank you very much for spending time with us again this morning.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Start out and tell us briefly, if you would, a little about the two organizations you founded, the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action and Mary's House.
Well, as you said, Mike, Ground Zero is actually next to the Trident base. It shares 330 feet of barbed wire fence with the Trident nuclear submarine base at Bangor, across from Seattle. And the Ground Zero community has been moving along now for 31 years this fall, 31st anniversary this fall, and right now is very much actively engaged in continuing a nonviolent presence alongside the Trident base, vigiling, resisting, getting arrested, challenging, and raising questions with people themselves in the base who have questions also about our continuing to move forward in nuclear weapons programs that are not only obsolete but that threaten everyone on the face of the earth. And Ground Zero is profoundly committed to nonviolence. Ground Zero means, of course, the point at which a nuclear weapon explodes, but in a more prophetic sense, it means that center of a chain reaction of nonviolence, which can transform the world. And we're as close as you can get to a nuclear weapon at Ground Zero, a nuclear weapon on the Trident base. It's just in a little ways to SWPAC, Strategic Weapons Facility Pacific, the high security area where the nuclear weapons are actually stored and prepared for use on the Trident sub. So Ground Zero is the point at which we either explode or we get transformed. Mary's House is a Catholic worker house of hospitality in Birmingham, Alabama, that Shelley, my wife, and I co-founded. And it's going on 16 years now, and we help especially people who are visiting prisoners in nearby prisons, or who have problems with housing and with sustenance when they are visiting families in our local hospitals. Birmingham is a huge hospital complex nowadays, and so we try to help people, especially who are coming to Birmingham and who don't have a way to stay on when they are trying to visit their family members. That's what we do.
All right, so you have just completed a major book. Tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, JFK and the Unspeakable?
The motivation came especially not from JFK, but from Martin Luther King. It came because his assassination changed my life. It came when I was a professor of religion at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu in, of course, April 1968. And while I was teaching a course there on the theology of peace, these students took so seriously what we were speaking about and exploring in our classes that when King gave his life for peace and justice and in resistance to the Vietnam War and in a vision of ending poverty in the United States, they took a stand, and they came into class in the first class we had after King died and said they had had a little gathering on the other side of the campus, had burned their draft cards, thereby becoming liable to years in prison, which they would in fact serve. Some of the members of the Hawaii Resistance, the group they formed, went to jail for 6 months, some for 2 years. And within a month, I had joined them and was in jail also for helping to block a troop convoy of brothers who had been pulled out of the Hawaii National Guard and were on their way to Vietnam. So that was the beginning of the end of my academic career and the initiation of trying to follow the way of nonviolence that King had gone on and that we understood in our class came from Jesus, Gandhi, Dorothy Day, a whole success, many successors in kind of nonviolence as a way of life. So King's assassination was the beginning of life for a number of us, and John Kennedy's assassination was something I had to catch up to by analogy. It took 31 years really to understand the exact forces behind King's assassination. I went to a trial in 1999 in Memphis, where King, of course, had died, and the trial was on a wrongful death lawsuit that was initiated by Coretta Scott King and her family against one man who had confessed his role in a very sophisticated government plot to kill Martin Luther King. There were 70 witnesses in that wrongful death lawsuit, and during the 3 weeks of the trial, there was just overwhelming evidence that it was a conspiracy that included U.S. government agencies, and the jury, six black and six white people, concluded that Martin Luther King Jr. was indeed assassinated by a conspiracy that specifically involved government agencies. That's in their verdict. It's written into their verdict. And that trial, incidentally, was remarkably unobserved by the media. I was there the entire trial, and I saw who came and went, and only for a few days did it include any media people on a national level, and they had come when all the evidence had already been put into the record. And there was a woman next to me who was from Portugal, the largest daily in Lisbon. She said to me, you know, Americans say that the trial of Clinton is the trial of the century, or they say that the trial of O.J. Simpson is the trial of the century. And then she said, this is the trial of the century, and who's here? You, a writer of books, and me, a reporter from Lisbon. She looks around at a mostly empty courtroom. She's just dismayed, and I was dismayed and continue to be. In 2008, that trial is as unreported as it was in 1999. It's online at the kingcenter.com, and there are thousands of pages of evidence, and it's just ignored. So I felt called to write on that subject, to work in an experiment in truth that would include not only Dr. King's assassination, but the other three huge assassinations of the 1960s, those of Malcolm X, John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy. And it's an experiment in truth, in Gandhi's terms, one in which you move as far as you can into the truth, regardless of the consequences, and in the hope and the belief that the most powerful force on earth and in the universe is truth, the other side of love. That's a Gandhian understanding, and I believe in it. the four assassinations are four variations of the same story and the same theme. And the reason I've worked especially on the John Kennedy assassination is chronologically that's the first one. So then comes Malcolm, he's number two, and 65, and then Martin and RFK in 68. So for the last 12 years, I've been working on all four, but concentrating especially on writing the story, that's it, the story of why and how, but especially why John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
And did you come upon the answer, do you believe, of why John F. Kennedy was assassinated?
Yes, and I was astounded. Let me put it as briefly and as succinctly as I can, because I think the story has to be understood in terms of the why in order for us to see the nature of his assassination. The nature of it is something that goes way, way beyond anything I could have understood earlier or did understand. It took me more than 30 years to catch up to what was going on there. So the story, as I understand it, in brief, and I just put it in about four or five sentences, is that on our behalf, he was president of the United States, so it's on our behalf, at the height of the Cold War, John F. Kennedy risked committing the greatest crime in history, starting a nuclear war. Before we knew it, he turned toward peace with the enemy who almost committed that crime with him, Nikita Khrushchev. For turning to peace with his enemy and ours, Kennedy was murdered by a power we cannot easily describe. Its unspeakable reality can be traced, suggested, recognized, and pondered. And that's one purpose of telling the story. The other is simply to describe Kennedy's turning, because he turned profoundly. So the hope of telling that story of JFK's encounter with the unspeakable is that we will be willing to encounter it too. That's it, very as briefly as I can state it, but it goes into a darkness on which I felt I needed and we need a spiritual guide. So in moving into that, I've literally asked the assistance of Thomas Merton in terms of hoping that he could be present. Of course, he died in 1968, not long after Robert Kennedy did. But in hoping that Merton, in his questions, in his insights into what was going on in this period of time, could provide a way into the assassination. And I found that to be true. And the unspeakable in the title of the book, JFK and the Unspeakable, is from Merton. He wrote a great series of essays under the title and theme, Raids on the Unspeakable. And by the unspeakable, Merton meant a kind of systemic evil and darkness that goes beyond the capacity of words to describe. It goes where we do where we do not want to go, and it's it involves a kind of lying a lying that takes us into a vacuum of responsibility. It's what the Central Intelligence Agency calls plausible deniability. So that's where Merton becomes especially helpful.
Does the unspeakable also include at all our lack of asking tough questions and our turning away from obvious truths?
That's the void. It's the void of responsibility that that is our part of the unspeakable. The unspeakable is, in a systemic sense, a government evasion of responsibility, but in a much more personal sense, it's our refusal to go where the darkness of Hiroshima, of Nagasaki, of Buchenwald, of Auschwitz, of the killings of JFK, RFK, Malcolm Martin, of Vietnam, of the escalation of the nuclear arms race, all of these things that we don't want to see as our own responsibility and just want to attribute to the government, that's the unspeakable, just as much as it is the government's refusal to accept responsibility for it. So where they won't, we won't accept responsibility, where there's a vacuum, into that vacuum comes a force of evil, a force of killing, a force of lying. The killing and the lying are two sides of the same reality that results, in this case, in the assassination of the President of the United States because he is seeking peace.
All right, maybe you could go into a little more of the transition of John F. Kennedy from when he was carrying out these, on some levels, or considering, you know, these unspeakable acts like total nuclear war or just the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, and your the facts that you've come across for his changing of that policy and his viewpoints.
Sure. Well, I'd like to keep it in the perspective of Merton, so I want to share how Merton asked the question about Kennedy in a skeptical way and at the same time a prophetic way in a letter that he wrote just a year into Kennedy's presidency. He didn't think Kennedy was up to his task, and I think he was right. In the initial phases of the presidency, Kennedy, of course, allowed the Bay of Pigs invasion to occur. It was prepared by the CIA under Eisenhower, but Kennedy allowed it to go forward. And at that time, and in the months after it, Merton wrote this letter in which he said, "I have little confidence in Kennedy. I think he cannot fully measure up to the magnitude of his task. He lacks creative imagination and the deeper kind of sensitivity that is needed. Too much the time and life mentality," referring to the Henry Luce publications, "than which," Merton says, "I can imagine nothing further in reality from, say, Lincoln. What is needed is really not shrewdness or craft, but what the politicians don't have: depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination." I think Merton understood both Kennedy's limitations and his faults as he moved into his tasks as president, and he also understood prophetically exactly what needed to happen. He was praying for it to happen, for Kennedy to, as Merton put it, break through into that kind of deeper and wider humanity by miracle, and he also understood the consequence: he would be marked out for assassination. In the first major crisis of Kennedy's foreign policy, he consented to the invasion by Cuban exiles trained and controlled by the CIA at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. That, he felt, in retrospect, was a manipulation by the CIA. They had lied to him. They had said that if the exiles landed at the Bay of Pigs, that there would be an uprising on the part of the Cuban people, that the Cuban people were so profoundly opposed to the revolution that they would overthrow Fidel Castro. Well, CIA knew that wasn't the case, and Kennedy was skeptical too, but he thought, well, their intelligence was something he had to rely on. But secondly, they also said that if the exile force, when it landed, got into military trouble, they could go into the mountains and do the same thing that Fidel Castro and the revolutionary group that he was working with had done. Well, there was no access to that kind of terrain at the Bay of Pigs. They were lying to him. And the reason they were lying to Kennedy was that he had drawn a line. He had said, I will not, under any circumstances, send in U.S. troops to Cuba. No combat troops. I'm not going to do that, no matter what happens. And they felt that by putting this young, inexperienced president in a situation where the Cuban forces were going to win, that he would have to send in heavy bombing, and he would have to send in the troops who were in U.S. ships off the coast of Cuba. Kennedy said, no, I won't do it. And he took the defeat at the Bay of Pigs rather than up the ante, as the CIA and the Joint Chiefs thought he would have to. He not only did that, but he was infuriated by what had happened and in the manipulation by the CIA and the Joint Chiefs. And he said, I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. And he then fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, a man who of enormous power, the brother to John Foster Dulles. The two of them had controlled foreign policy in the United States government during the 1950s under Eisenhower. Not under Eisenhower. They, in effect, were over Eisenhower in terms of the way they used their offices. Kennedy fired Alan Dulles. Then he fired the people under Dulles who were responsible for the Bay of Pigs, Richard Bissell, who was head of covert action, Charles Cabell, who was a general in the Air Force. And incidentally, his brother was mayor of Dallas in November 1963. So Kennedy was then, from that point on, persona non grata to the CIA, and he in turn was deeply suspicious of both the CIA and his major military authorities, because they had manipulated and pushed him into position as president that he rebelled against. So he was rebelling against his chief advisors in intelligence and in the military for the rest of his presidency. It all began at the Bay of Pigs, but it all climaxed in the Cuban Missile Crisis in a remarkable way.
And you believe then at some point in there that he started working with his counterpart in the Soviet Union, Khrushchev, in reversing these policies that had been going forward.
Yes, the relationship between Kennedy and Khrushchev is an untold story. It lies especially behind his assassination. It's a very complex relationship. They met only one time. It was in Vienna in 1961. It was a meeting that upset Kennedy very much. It was one in which he felt Khrushchev was insensitive to the danger and the threat of nuclear war. There was one point at which Kennedy had a a ship that he gave to Khrushchev, a model of the USS Constitution, a sailing ship on which there were cannons, and in a battle with the USS Constitution, as he pointed out to Khrushchev, a few people on an opposing ship and a few people on the Constitution would be killed by cannonballs, and then he said, but today, you know, millions, really the whole planet, would go in an exchange of nuclear weapons between you and me, your forces and my forces. And Khrushchev just sat there and looked at him. Now, that look may have conveyed different things, but to Kennedy it communicated, perhaps wrongly from his, you know, from the standpoint of what Khrushchev was thinking, insensitivity. And Kennedy did achieve some results with Khrushchev at that meeting, but he thought that there was a storm coming. And I use that term because he had a little prayer from Abraham Lincoln that he wrote out on the night when he was going back to Washington from that meeting in a plane. He was falling asleep, and he scribbled on a piece of paper Lincoln's little prayer: I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. And Kennedy saw the storm of nuclear war coming. He saw, and certainly partly, very much partly as a result of his own actions and Khrushchev's, and the conflict that was intensifying between them on an ideological basis, absolute something and absolute something else, good versus evil, an ideological conflict that on both sides of capitalism and communism, of the free world and the communist world, as the U.S. put it, that was going to result in a clash that could destroy all of civilization, and for that matter, the world, all of civilization, being our way of defining our part of the world. And so Kennedy suggested to Khrushchev at that meeting that maybe they ought to try to communicate informally and beneath the radar of their advisors. And it was a suggestion that Khrushchev took up that fall, and he wrote a secret letter to John F. Kennedy. He sat down in a retreat of his home near the Black Sea, as I recall, and he wrote this letter, very beautifully begun letter, reflecting on the sea and the trees and the shore, and how in this setting he wanted to write to JFK about the hope for peace. And he had a remarkable symbol in this opening letter that he introduced. Recall, of course, that Khrushchev is the communist, the atheist, and he brings up Noah's Ark. He says, you know, we really ought to recognize that we're on Noah's Ark, you and I are, and all of us. He meant all of us on your side and my side and everybody in between. And he said, let's not talk about who the clean and the unclean are on this ark. Let's talk about all of us. And Kennedy received that letter wrapped up in a newspaper, smuggled into his press secretary's office by a KGB, a communist agent. And of course, Pierre Salinger, the secretary, didn't understand why he was being given a newspaper by a KGB agent for the president of the United States, and he had questioned it, and the guy said, well, just look inside, give it to the president. Inside was a 20-page secret, informal, personally written letter to John F. Kennedy from Nikita Khrushchev. Their secret correspondence continued for the rest of Kennedy's presidency until he was assassinated. And in that correspondence, they struggled with each other directly without any intervening people involved on the key issues of the Cold War. And even when they were at their deepest conflict, and even when the world was on the brink of nuclear war, there was something beneath the surface that went beyond our understanding and even imagination, because they had a relationship through their secret letters. So how does that affect things? Well, at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when on the 12th day of the 13-day crisis, that was October 28th, Saturday, a U.S. spy plane, the U-2, was shot down over Cuba by a Soviet surface-to-air missile. A terrible moment, one in which the advisors to Kennedy from the National Security Council, certainly the Joint Chiefs, CIA, everybody said, now, we have to take out the Soviet missiles. We have to destroy those that they are trying to arm with nuclear warheads. We've got to destroy them in Cuba before they actually are armed with nuclear warheads, and before they are capable of striking the United States. And Kennedy refused. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he also understood something that none of his advisors understood, that to do such a thing would take us into a nuclear war. And unknown to him, and unknown to all of the people on our side, those nuclear warheads had already been put on the missiles in Cuba. So had the United States tried to take out the Soviet missiles before they were armed, because they had already been armed, we would have had a nuclear war if Kennedy had submitted to those pressures. Instead, he sent Robert Kennedy secretly to Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin in Washington to issue an appeal to his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev. He said through RFK to Dobrynin, I'm losing control. I don't think I can stop this from happening. I need your help. He had reached a point of desperation. His Joint Chiefs especially were already engaged in provocative actions to try to get to trap the Soviets into giving some sign of going immediately to war, so that the U.S. could strike with our overwhelming dominance of nuclear weapons. We had far more nuclear weapons than the Soviets did. And we, namely the Joint Chiefs especially, wanted not only to attack the missile sites on Cuba, they wanted to attack the Soviet Union. They wanted to win the Cold War, which meant, in their terms, taking out 150 million Soviet citizens and losing only 40 million on our side. They wanted to win. So when Kennedy sent this message through his brother to Dobrynin, and Dobrynin wired it to Khrushchev, Khrushchev realized the plight of his enemy, Kennedy, and he turned to his foreign minister, Andrei Gromyko, and he said, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. Gromyko looked at him as if he had gone crazy, and Khrushchev repeated it aloud, almost to convince himself, I think. He said, yes, we have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war. And at that moment, and in the subsequent minutes when Khrushchev went on the radio and the television and said he was withdrawing the Soviet missiles from Cuba, the world of conflict in the Cold War and the adversarial relationship between John F. Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev turned upside down. And each of them, each of these leaders, Kennedy on the one hand and Khrushchev on the other, became closer to each other in their understanding and in their subsequent actions than either of them was to his own national security state. And that had profound implications and consequences for both themselves and the world.
Talk about the speech that John F. Kennedy gave at American University and its significance.
That was the response that Kennedy gave to Khrushchev, the speech on June 10, 1963, commencement address at American University in Washington, D.C. In the months after the missile crisis, after Khrushchev had withdrawn the Soviet missiles from Cuba, and after Kennedy had, in a secret pledge to Khrushchev that he carried out after he withdrew the U.S. missiles from Turkey, tit for tat, you know, a pledge and an action of doing for the Soviets what the Soviets had done for the U.S., namely a step of peace, withdrawing missiles from the border of the enemy, which incensed once again the Joint Chiefs and the CIA. After they had done that, and after Kennedy had pledged never to invade Cuba, then they struggled on the issue of a nuclear test ban treaty. What Kennedy and Khrushchev realized they had to do to move in exactly the opposite direction. They had been terrified by the position they had placed themselves in and the world. And they saw from this new relationship that they had, underlying which was their secret correspondence, that they could move in a direction of a peaceful world that would be of great benefit to both their countries and to the forces on both sides of the Cold War. And they had to do that by concrete steps, and the first one was to be a nuclear test ban. But there was the question of inspections, and Khrushchev suspected, and I think rightly, that if there were inspections in the Soviet Union, that intelligence agencies on the part of the United States would try to use those for gaining information that would be beyond that required for a nuclear test ban. So they struggled over that, and finally Khrushchev said, I'm not budging anymore on the number of inspections. It's up to Kennedy to take a step. And Norman Cousins, a remarkable man, the editor of the Saturday Review, who was going as was a go-between on the ground between Kennedy and Khrushchev, taking secret messages back and forth between them, and not incidentally stopping in Rome to talk with Pope John the 23rd, who was issuing appeals for peace that both Kennedy and Khrushchev were being moved by. In that process, Cousins said to Kennedy in the spring, you've got to make a great speech for peace. He challenged JFK. And JFK accepted the challenge, and he accepted Khrushchev's challenge that it was up to him to take a step now. Khrushchev had taken the first step in the missile crisis. He'd pulled back his missiles publicly at a point that placed a lot of pressure on him. And so Kennedy, in his American University address, he gave what Khrushchev called the greatest speech any American president has done since Roosevelt. He reached out to the enemy by describing the pain and the suffering and the death of Soviet people during World War II. He described a kind of destruction and of just overwhelming devastation in their country that would have included everything in the United States east of Chicago. And then he said, "This will be nothing compared to what will happen if there is a nuclear exchange between." The enemy, I never used the term enemy, between their country and our country. And then he said, you know, this speech is devoted to peace. And what kind of peace do I mean? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. And by that reference, he was coming out foursquare against the military-industrial complex. A Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war is precisely what Eisenhower was talking about in the phrase military-industrial complex, and what created enormous profits for the forces in the United States that were most compelling us toward war. And then Kennedy said, I, from this point on, will not test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere unless somebody else does. It was a unilateral initiative. He said, we want to go to Moscow. Of course, that's the capital of the other side, the Soviet Union. And he said, we want to obtain a test ban treaty. And Khrushchev and he did it in 6 weeks. In the 6 weeks after that speech, Kennedy and Khrushchev negotiated the limited test ban treaty, the first step in ending the Cold War. And they did so in what was, from the standpoint of Kennedy, an end run around his military advisors. He didn't consult any of them. He said, we're going ahead. We've got to do this. It has to be done. And when his representative, Averell Harriman, went to Moscow and was there talking with the Soviet negotiators, every time any kind of particular question on the wording of the treaty came up, Averell Harriman would run to a phone and he'd make a phone call to Washington. The Soviets said, well, who are you talking to? He said, John Kennedy. Kennedy personally negotiated that entire treaty from the White House without his military advisors being involved. And, of course, they thought this was, from their standpoint, a surrender from an advantage that the U.S. needed to have by further testing. And then from that point on, it was one thing after another. Then Kennedy got the treaty by an enormous act of turnaround on the part of the American public through the U.S. Senate, and he gained the Senate's approval of the treaty. And he did that by working with the U.S. peace movement. Norman Cousins was the chairperson of SANE, Committee for a SANE Nuclear Policy, and Cousins organized peace activists and editors and people working at women's magazines especially to just engage in a terrific public education campaign in August and September, and it turned public opinion around. It was very deeply opposed to the test ban, and Kennedy, by his personal appeal over radio and TV and all these other folk he was working with and peace activists, got the Senate to pass it. And then Kennedy began secret negotiations with Fidel Castro, considered even more the devil from the standpoint of the overriding theology of absolute good versus absolute evil that we were following in the Cold War, just as we follow it today in the so-called War on Terror. He began to open up to Cuba, and he had an assistant to Adlai Stevenson communicating directly to Castro and to work out meetings so that the U.S. representative William Atwood, the assistant to Stevenson and Castro, could begin to move forward on normalizing relationship between U.S. and Cuba, something that hasn't happened to this day. And on the very day that Kennedy was assassinated, another intermediary that Kennedy had sent to Castro, a man named Jean Daniel, a reporter from a Paris newspaper who had met with Kennedy in the White House and had gotten Kennedy's specific questions to Castro. He took them to Castro, met with him in Cuba, and Castro was just deeply moved that Kennedy was doing this, and he spent an entire night and morning with Daniel and kept telling him, repeat to me, what did Kennedy say then? And Daniel would say for the third or fourth time exactly what he had heard from Kennedy that Kennedy supported the Cuban Revolution, but he had strong questions about Castro's relationship to the Soviet Union and what had happened in the missile crisis and so forth. And they were struggling together, Kennedy and Castro, at the very moment when Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Jean Daniel was having lunch with Fidel Castro, and they were working at those issues, and Castro received a phone call that Kennedy had been shot, and then subsequently that he'd been killed, and he stood up and he said, "Everything is changed. Everything is going to change." And of course that went nowhere. That normalization of relations between Cuba and the U.S. went nowhere with Lyndon Johnson, nor did the other key issue that Kennedy had reached a decision on, Vietnam. In October of 1963, Kennedy signed a National Security Action Memorandum that would have ended the Vietnam War, withdrawing 1,000 U.S. troops by the end of 63 and everybody out of Vietnam from the U.S. side by 65. A National Security Memorandum that went to the side and was deep-sixed by the subsequent administration. So a lot of things were happening, and a lot of turning on the part of Kennedy, a profound change from him as a cold warrior when he entered the presidency, a deep relationship that was established by the secret correspondence with Khrushchev, a breakthrough by miracle, if you want to put it in Thomas Merton's terms, that these two enemies turned toward each other at the most crucial moment in the history of all of us, at a point where we were almost into a total nuclear war, that they not only stopped doing that, they turned to each other and decided very courageously on the part of both of them to move toward the vision of a disarmed and new world. And as a result, John Kennedy was assassinated by his national security state, and Nikita Khrushchev, in the year after that assassination, lost power, was overthrown in the Soviet Union.
We are talking with Jim Douglas. He is author of the new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. Talk a little bit about... You said he was murdered by his own security state. Talk about the power behind the power, because that seems to be part of the unspeakable that no one ever discusses. Utah Phillips, who just passed away recently, mm-hmm. has a saying that I hope I get it right. The earth is not dying; she's being killed, and those doing the killing have names and addresses. Those that make up some of the unspeakable, are they, you know, specific people that we can point to, or is it more an institution that needs to be addressed?
Well, it's certainly both. Institutions are made up by people, but institutions also go beyond, and in the sense that St. Paul identified them, principalities and powers, and in the sense that Merton is speaking about in the unspeakable. To name a specific individual, the one that John F. Kennedy fired, Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, he emerges in a remarkable new position right after the assassination. The man who logically should be considered at the very least a primary suspect in the Kennedy assassination, a man who came to hate John Kennedy because he was removed from his, well, it was a power that was almost beyond power as the head of the CIA, and as being in charge of covert forces that could do virtually anything they wanted under the doctrine of plausible deniability. His firing by Kennedy placed him in a position that he hated. But as soon as Kennedy is assassinated, where is Alan Dulles? He is appointed to the Warren Commission to investigate the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It should have been called the Dulles Commission, not the Warren Commission. Dulles was the most powerful individual on it. Warren was a titular head of it. And so now we have the Fox investigating the murder of the hens in the hen house. Certainly Dulles and those in the remaining in the CIA who remained profoundly under the influence of Dulles are the primary suspects from day one. So specifically, Richard Helms, head of covert action in the CIA, specifically James Jesus Angleton, the head of counterintelligence in the CIA, and who was responsible for controlling and sending Lee Harvey Oswald as a CIA operative to the Soviet Union as a fake defector in the late 1950s. Oswald was working with the Central Intelligence Agency, and Oswald was being scapegoated in the Kennedy assassination. James Jesus Angleton and a man named David Atlee Phillips, who was the chief propagandist in the CIA, were moving Oswald from point to point from New Orleans, and people impersonating Oswald in Mexico City, going to the Soviet and Cuban consulates in September of 1963, with giving all kinds of phony evidence to implicate Oswald, not simply as a person who was going to kill Kennedy, that was certainly being indicated, but who was going to be supposedly operating under the control of Cuba and the Soviet Union. Those strips of people saying, "I am Lee Harvey Oswald, and here is my gun." He actually put his gun on the table in the Soviet consulate and indicated that he was going to do all kinds of things. He was even meeting with a man who the CIA identified as the head of assassinations in the Western Hemisphere for the Soviet KGB. This supposed Oswald character, it was somebody impersonating him, was trying to implicate those forces, Soviet and Cuban, in the assassination of Kennedy beforehand. So when the assassination was carried out, Johnson, the new president, was being presented with documentation, so-called fake phone calls, fake visits to the Soviet and Cuban consulates that would show beyond a reasonable doubt that Kennedy had been murdered by his communist opponents, the very people that he was trying to negotiate a peace with. That was the further purpose of the plot to kill Kennedy. It was not only to kill the President of the United States, it was to once again supposedly win the Cold War by using that as the pretext for invading Cuba and striking the Soviet Union with our predominance of nuclear weapons. So the unspeakable goes beyond the assassination of John Kennedy. Fortunately, that part of the plot was not realized. And Lyndon Johnson, he saw that the evidence was phony. He did not have the courage to confront the CIA as his predecessor JFK had. So he turned away from that step, but he didn't go with the so-called evidence and accept that, because that would have meant pressures to invade Cuba and to launch a nuclear war against the Soviets. He didn't want to begin his presidency with a nuclear war. So he chose instead a phony cover-up, a phony investigation called the Warren Commission, and in which Alan Dulles led the lies and covered up everything, all the phony evidence that would have implicated the CIA in reality more than it would have implicated the Soviet Union and Cuba. So the absurdity of the lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, was therefore born as a result of Johnson trying to avoid either having the courage to confront the CIA or the stupidity to and the insanity of invading the Soviet Union. That's the unspeakable.
Only a few minutes left. The subtitle of your book, Why He Died and Why It Matters. If you could, in a nutshell, why it matters.
Why it matters. Let's take an example in the current presidential campaign. That matters. It matters who gets elected president of the United States this fall. It matters whether or not we're moving in the direction of war, nuclear war, once again, or in the direction of peace. In February, Barack Obama was endorsed by Caroline and Ted Kennedy. Where did that happen? Let's think a moment. It happened at American University. It happened on the site of John F. Kennedy's prophetic speech, for which he was murdered by his national security state, a speech in which he envisioned a world that was not dominated by American weapons of war, a speech in which he said at its conclusion, we need to pursue a strategy of peace. For Caroline and Ted Kennedy to endorse Obama at that point meant that they believed and hoped that that particular candidate, Barack Obama, would pursue that vision of peace that John F. Kennedy had articulated and for which he had died. And the implication being that anybody who would try to do that would risk a similar fate. It's up to us. It's not up to Barack Obama by himself. If he goes in that direction, as I certainly hope he does and pray he does, just as Merton prayed that John Kennedy would go in that direction, he will become just as isolated as Kennedy did in his presidency unless he has deep support, unless he has prophetic movements going on in this country and in the world. They're certainly going on in the world. They certainly are going on in this country. But unless those move much more than they have so far against our national security state and to transform it into something approaching a real democracy, then the same events will be repeated, and we'll have the events of 1963 and of 65 and of 68, where John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy were assassinated, repeated in one form or another. Whether it's an assassination or election fraud, the results become the same, namely refusing to accept the will of the people. And the will of the people in 1963, at the end of that presidency, were deeply in favor of disarmament. Kennedy had moved the people to a point where, moved us to a point where we got a nuclear test ban treaty passed through a very skeptical Senate. That's the kind of change that's possible. Today, we see a lot of things going on in the movement supporting Obama. There are a lot of things going on in the peace and justice movement that need to not only go on, but to deepen if the event of November 1963 is not to be repeated, and if instead we are to move toward a world of peace that John F. Kennedy envisioned and died for.
Talking with Jim Douglas, author of the new book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. So with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike.